Well, this week we continue with our second week of what we're calling the Torah Project. For those of you who weren't here last week, what's going on is this, is that I am working on my second book now, which is going to be a commentary on the Torah. But right now we're just going to make it a commentary on Genesis. We'll see how that goes. And so I've been writing my brains out for the last couple of weeks. I have 26 pages written and ready to go. And so what I do is each week, I just kind of take what I've been studying and writing during the week, and I share it with you. And so this week, as we continue into Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, we just go flying through Genesis, we want to look at something. As I mentioned, the prayer is very emotionally charged. My wife has been working at a Christian school, and this is the kind of book that is used there. I'm not going to give the name of it. I don't want to. It's not my job up here to mock error, as mockworthy as some error is. But this book is all about dinosaurs, and it is to solve the dinosaur mystery that's written for children. And imagine yourself as a child paging through this book, and then you see a picture of a guy here just, having a fun time with the dinosaurs around. There's a picture of him a little later on, and he's scratching one behind the ears and putting it on the head, and this little dinosaur just kind of oohing and awing. Oh, here are the dinosaurs going onto the ark, by the way. I mean, who makes this up? And they say things like this. France, the city of Nurluk, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, was renamed in honor of the killing of a dragon there. The animal was bigger than an ox and had long, sharp, pointed horns on its head. There were a number of different horned dinosaurs. The Triceratops is one example. So there you see the castle in France in the background. There's the dead Triceratops in the yard right in front of the castle. Images are powerful. And when we feed these kinds of images to our children, thinking that we're defending the faith, oh, here's the guy. Look at him. He's there just petting the dinosaur. You can see that. You should see the dinosaur's face. He's just in nirvana. His eyes are closed. He's smiling. And as he gets his ears scratched, dinosaurs don't have ears, really. But there's a little rabbit back here, and the guy's petting the dinosaur. And this is the kind of stuff that is being produced because there's great fear that if we don't get the children to believe what the Bible says, that when they get into college and they're confronted with the theory of evolution and carbon dating and the age of the world, that their faith will collapse. What these well-meaning people do not realize is that they're setting up their children for loss of faith. Because I agree with the statement, unless we teach our children the truth, their faith will collapse. So my contention is, let's teach them the truth. And what this book presents is not truth. It's the product of fear, is what it is. And so what I want us to look at is go to the first two verses of Genesis and look at some other scriptures. And before you get all concerned that, oh, Grant is going to teach us that we all evolved from monkeys. No, I don't believe that we evolved from monkeys. I believe we are descendants of Adam and Eve, who were created about 6,000 years ago. All right, let's just get that right out in front. I'm not going to be talking about evolution, that we evolved from pond scum or whatever. All right? Our first parents were Adam and Eve. They lived somewhere around 6,000 years ago. Got it. That is not a problem. So we're all together on that. But everything else is up for grabs. So here's the problem. Here on the left, I have Genesis 1, verses 1 and 2. We're all very familiar with this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was formless and void. The words for formless and void in Hebrew are tohu and vohu. Remember those two words, tohu and Vohu. And darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. Now, if you just read that, this is what it appears to be saying. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But boy, it was a mess. It was dark, it was chaotic, it was empty. So over 6 days, God had to shape up this mess that he had made in the beginning. Others, on the other hand, say, no. What verse 1 is doing is introducing the chapter. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, here's how he did it. The earth was formless and void, but that doesn't answer the question, where did the earth come from? Now here, we now on the right have Isaiah 45:18. And it makes a real conflict with Genesis 1, 1 and 2. Isaiah 45:18 says, "For thus says Adonai, who created the heavens, he is the God who formed the earth and made it. He established it and did not create it formless." That in the word tohu is used there. He didn't make it tohu, but formed it to be inhabited. I am Adonai. There's nothing else. So, I want you to see the conflict here. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was formless and void. But it says here, I didn't make the earth formless and void. I made it inhabitable. So who's right? Who's wrong? Well, this is God's inspired word. They're both right. What is wrong is our understanding of the two passages. What the two passages are saying is that God made the earth in the beginning. And it was perfect. It was wonderful. It was amazing. It was inhabitable. There was no flaw in it. But something happened, and it became formless and void. That is what happened. And you see, our English translations aren't very good at translating Hebrew. And any of you who've been learning Hebrew have realized that. Hebrew defies translation oftentimes. I want us to learn a Hebrew word. The Hebrew word is the word haya. It's like saying haya. Okay, everybody say haya. All right, haya. That's the word for be. And in Hebrew, as in most languages, there are genders. There's masculine gender, there's feminine gender, and every object is either masculine or feminine. This is what drives English speakers crazy when they try to learn Spanish or Italian or something else, because you don't just have to remember the name of an object. You have to remember, is that a feminine object or a masculine object? Is that a chair is masculine or feminine, you know? But Hebrew's the same way. Now, Greek is even more complicated. It's got the feminine and masculine and transgender. Neuter. Okay? It's got three. And you have to memorize any object. You have to memorize what its gender is. But in most languages, it's either feminine or masculine, one or the other. So, if you're describing a masculine object, you use the word haya, which is the masculine form of the word to be. If you're describing a feminine object, use the word haita. That's feminine. But they mean the same thing. It's the same word. But one is for describing masculine, one is for describing feminine. So in Genesis 1:2, it says, Vaha'aretz haita. It uses the feminine because the word for earth is a feminine word. Okay? So we can put a little F period underneath that. It's a feminine word, so the word haita is used, and earth was. If the earth was masculine, it would have said vaha'aretz haya, but it's feminine, so it's haita. But the words mean the same thing. Are we clear? So when you go to look up these words, it's always going to give you the masculine. That's always the root. And in the Brown Driver Briggs, which is like the authoritative Hebrew English lexicon, it gives us definition. The word means to fall out. In other words, it doesn't mean like fall out of the truck. It means to come to pass, to become, or to be. That's how this word is used. Let's look at some examples of how haya and haita are used. In Genesis 3:22, it says, "Then Adonai Elohim said, behold, the man has become haya like one of us, knowing good and evil." Did Adam know good and evil when he was first created? No. He rebelled against God. He and Eve, they ate of the fruit of the tree, and then they knew good and evil. So God says they have become like one of us. And that's the word Haya. Here's the feminine form, and Sarah laughed. This is Genesis 18:12. Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I've become old, shall there be," that's the word haita, "for me pleasure," my Lord being old also. In other words, I'm old. I'm way beyond the state of having children. She was 90 years old. She was beyond the age of sexual intimacy, and she's saying, I'm going to become sexually intimate again with my 100-year-old husband? Really? No wonder she laughed. Genesis 47:26, "And Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, valid to this day, that Pharaoh should have Pharaoh, you get the fifth, right? He gets the fifth of the land. Only the land of the priest did not become Haita, Pharaoh's." Same word used in Genesis 1:2. Oh, and how about this one? Exodus 8:15. "But when Pharaoh saw that there was relief," haita, in other words, relief occurred, "he hardened his heart." But here's a real kicker. Exodus 8:17. "And Aaron stretched out his hand with his staff and struck the dust of the earth, and there were gnats on the man and beast, and all the dust of the earth became," that's the word haya, "gnats to all the land of Egypt." Was it always gnats? No, it became gnats. So why is it that in Genesis 1:2 we insist we translate the word haita as was instead of became? In fact, almost every place this word is used is some kind of a change in state. Almost every place it's used. In fact, the way we use the word was in English often means a change in state. I missed you last week. Where were you? I was sick. Does that mean you were sick from the day you were born? No, it means I became ill, and therefore I could not come. I'm better now. I called you, but there was no answer. Well, I was at the store. That means you were born and raised, and you stay in the store? No. I changed my location from being in my home to being in the store, but I'm back home now. It's a change of state, change of position, change of condition. So when we take Genesis 1:2, it makes total sense now. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Time passes. But the earth became formless and void. There's darkness on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God hovered over the waters. You begin to see? See, here's the bottom line. Adam and Eve were created about 6,000 years ago, but the planet was already incredibly old. And when you have that understanding, all of a sudden, all this conflict between science and the Bible, it disappears. Simply disappears. I've shared with you before, last time we went through Genesis years ago, how my saintly mother, when I was a child, sat me down. I came home from grade school. I went to Milroy Elementary School, and they've been talking about dinosaurs and the age of the world and all these things, and a guy came with a big dinosaur bone, and I came home, and I just was confused. Mom, how old is the world? You know, because I thought Adam and Eve only lived, you know. And she sat me down and she explained to me when I was about 8 years old what I'm explaining to you. And you know what she shared with me now that I'm almost 64 has stood fast. And though my faith has been tested in other areas, never this. I taught for a number of years, and he's still a good, very good friend of mine who's a geologist. He teaches geology at Akron U and has done for many years. So I ran this by him. I said, "Nick, let me lay this out to you. Is there anything scientifically wrong with this view I have? I see the scriptures teaching." He listened to it and says, "No, none at all. Makes perfect sense." But when you start trying to drive it home into children's heads, the world is 6,000 years old. That's what the Bible says. It's not what the Bible says. If we want our children to have strong faith, teach them the truth. And the only reason people will try to drive home this idea that the world's only 6,000 years old is out of fear. Or out of hatred. They've heard about evolution, they hate that idea so much that they swing this direction and they take the Bible and they turn it in some kind of extreme and they will stop their ears against any teaching that is biblical that really teaches the truth about how everything fits together. So let's move on a bit. The question arises, is there any place else in the Bible that describes this? I mean, this cataclysmic event, whatever it was that destroyed the earth, and then required God over 6 days to restore it, is there any other place in the Bible that discusses it? Yeah, there are a few places. And I believe one of the best is Jeremiah 4, verses 23 to 28. So turn there for a moment. It's too long of a passage for me to put the whole thing up here on the slide, but you can just take a look at it in your own Bibles. Jeremiah 4, verses 23 to 28. It says, I looked on the earth, and behold, it was tohu and vohu. Sound familiar? Now, let me say this. The words tohu and vohu appear other places in Scripture, but there's only two places in the whole Bible where the phrase, it was tohu and vohu, it was formless and void, only two places that phrase appears, Genesis 1:2 and here in Jeremiah 4:23. So behold, it was formless and void. And I looked at the heavens, and they had no light. They had light, but now they don't. I looked on the mountains, and behold. Now, by the way, the word behold here is used four times. We tend in our English reading just to kind of skip over that word because we don't use the word behold very often. But behold in Hebrew, hine, is a powerful word. It's like it's to jump off the page, like, look at this, guys. This is important. So we've seen it once. Verse 23, behold, it become formless and void. And now we see it a second time. Behold, they were quaking. Look at the mountains. Behold, they were quaking, and all the hills moved to and fro. So these massive earthquakes. Verse 25, I looked, and behold, there are no people. All the birds of heaven had fled. I looked, verse 26, and behold, the fruitful land was a midbar. It was a wilderness. All its abodes, your translation says cities, the word for cities means just an abode, the dwellings, it could be whatever, were pulled down before Adonai, before his fierce anger. For thus says Adonai, the whole Aretz, your land translation may say land, but the word Aretz can mean land or it can mean earth, as it does back in Genesis 1:1. The whole earth shall be desolate. But look at this next phrase. Yet I will not execute a complete destruction. There's going to be something left behind. For this the earth shall mourn, and the heavens above will be dark, because I have spoken, I have purposed, and I will not change my mind while I turn from it. Fascinating stuff we have here. Now, you might be saying, well, Grant, wait a minute. Whoa. This, if you look earlier, Grant, the context is God sending Babylon to wipe out Jerusalem and Judea. I got it. I understand that. But what you have to realize is that in biblical prophecy, God, who is spirit, takes a spiritual view of events. And when one event and another event, and maybe a third and a fourth and a fifth event, all have the same spirit, all have the same tone, have the same energy, he describes them as one thing. We see this many times in prophecy. You know, we are physical, and we tend to see things as these separated individual kinds of things. God's spirit. He sees similarities. Let me just take one example we all understand. Psalms opens with the phrase, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly. And it goes on. Blessed is the man. What man? Which man is he talking about? Is he talking about Walt here or Walt there? Or is he talking about Michael or Jim? What man is he talking about? Well, any man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly is going to be blessed. So he's saying what I'm saying here about the man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly applies to every man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly. What I'm saying here about the destruction of Judea is a reflection of the same kind of anger I had at the rebellion that had taken place thousands of years ago when I destroyed the earth. It's the same sort of thing. The scale is different, but it's the same dynamic. I see it as the same sort of thing because I'm bringing destruction again because of rebellion. Now, you may be asking, who's rebelled? Well, we'll get to that. But look at the four beholds. There's a change in the earth itself. Violent earthquakes, destruction of animal life, destruction of plant life. And this definitely is what took place at the original destruction. It also says that the heavens went dark, the fruitful land became a wilderness, a midbar. Now remember that word midbar, wilderness. We're going to see it again in another passage. The entire land, the entire aretz, became desolate. Same word is used for earth in Genesis 1:1. Bereshit bara Elohim et haaretz. In the beginning, God created the earth. Okay? I mean, the heavens, vahaaretz. The heavens, vahaaretz, and the earth. The earth was destroyed in anger. It would go through a time of mourning. But it says God did not execute a complete destruction. There was something left to work with. The planet was still there. The heavenly bodies were still floating around up there somewhere. The land was still there. It was all covered with water. It would take 6 days to begin to restore the earth. Now, this is what's so fascinating as well. In Genesis 1:1, it says, Bereshit bara. In the beginning, he created. Now, the word bara is not used very often in the scriptures. Only about a dozen times. Because the word bara means to create out of nothing. And this doesn't happen very often. That's why it's not used very much. But the word to do or to make, the word asa, is used, I don't know, a couple thousand times or 1,200 times, I forget. That's a huge number of times in the Hebrew scriptures. But bara is a rare word. So if we're looking at 6 days of creation, you'd expect to see the word bara used on every day, wouldn't you? But it isn't. It's not used on the first day or the second or the third, or the fourth. It's not used until the fifth day when God had to create the animals. And the sixth day when he created man. Okay, he created the fish and the birds on the fifth day and then man on the sixth. That is when the word bara is used in the 6 days. It's not used except for that because he didn't have to create. He had to do a lot of sorting out, rearranging, cleaning up, organizing. There's no creating required. All the stuff was already there. Let's look at these days. On day one, he says, let there be light. It says, and the Lord and God said, Yihior Vahior, just four words. It's almost like light is, light was. Now, this light is what is called the primordial light. It's a spiritual light. And the rabbis talk about this light. It's almost like he had to move the darkness away and allow the light to pierce the darkness and come down to the earth. But the word bara is not used. In fact, nowhere in the Bible does it say God created light. The Bible says God is light, and in him is no darkness whatsoever. God is light. He didn't have to create it. But Isaiah 45 tells us that he is the one who forms the light and creates the darkness, because darkness had to be created. Think about it. Originally, there was just God. There was no creation. God is light. God's omnipresent. God is everywhere. So light is everywhere. There's no place you could go to avoid the light. But he had to create the darkness later when he created the universe. He had to form the light. He had to reduce it. He had to shape it. He had to filter it. But nowhere does the Bible ever say he created it. He is light. It didn't need to be created. Darkness did. On day two, it says, and he made an expanse. He separated the waters above from the waters below, and that allowed for this middle area, the expanse called the heavens. And so again, it's rearranging. The word bara, the word create, is not used. Now in verse 3, it talks about how he separated the dry land from the waters, and then the vegetation appears. Now this is really interesting. Didn't he create the plants and the trees and the vegetables and all of that? Of course he did. Way back in Genesis verse 1. He didn't have to recreate it again on day 3. Look at the language. Look at Genesis 1:11. Then God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind, with seed in them on the earth." Now, we read that, and our translators kind of nudge the translation, because when it says with seed in them on the earth, they think, well, oh, the seed is in the fruit. The seed is in the plants, and the plants are on the earth. That's not what it says in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it says, Asher zorovo al haaretz, because its seed is among it, on the earth. Seed's already there. Didn't need to be recreated. It was all there waiting for the light to come, the heat to get turned up, the dry land to appear, and seeds, the plants explode out of the ground. Didn't have to create the seed. They were created way back in verse 1. Didn't need to be recreated. The word create's not used on day 3. Day 4, God made the two great lights, but it's not the word create. He did the lights. You know, when you look at this, it's, you know, the sun and the moon and all the stars are there, but what we see is God maybe reigniting them, maybe is allowing their light now to penetrate and hit the earth. These become the vessels for God's light as he forms it and reduces it to a manageable level. And then I'm sure he set things in motion, because it says that these stars, these heavenly bodies, are for signs. Therefore, moedim, not seasons, that's a bad translation. The word is moedim, appointed times. You could read about the appointed times in Leviticus 23. That's where the moedim are described. He's already looking ahead to the holy days he would establish. And he placed them, wound them up, choreographed them, gave them their strength, placed them exactly where he wanted them, and kind of flipped the switch to turn them back on again. But they were already there. They were created back in verse 1. Okay, I see your hand up, and I think I've got both microphones or one of them up here. So let's get a microphone over here to Adam. And Adam, I'm going to ask you to talk fast like I am because of the time squeeze. Okay, here it comes.
I guess I just wanted to share two quick tidbits. Sure. I've been studying the luminaries just this past week.
Yeah.
Something that really struck me as interesting is every facet God touches on regarding the creation is relational to humans.
Yeah.
It's not an existential statement regarding the luminaries, because I think they have a separate function unrelated to us, but it's just a redefining of the relationship to us. And the second quick tidbit, chapter 2, verse 5 indicates that the plants were waiting on Adam.
Yes.
So I just thought that was
Yes. Yeah, because it says that no water, there was no rain. A mist went up from the earth. But the rabbis say God was waiting for Adam to pray for rain before he sent it, and the trees and everything exploded right out of the ground. It's an interesting concept. Thank you, Adam. Very good. Day 5. Then finally, at long last, we see the word create used. And God created the great sea creatures and the fish, the birds, and all of that. Because you see, there were bones still here from the dinosaurs or whatever creatures, whatever kind of ape-like beast might have lived on the earth. Their bones were here. We see those. We see the fossils. But God made brand new animals. He didn't resurrect the old ones. He made brand new ones. So the word create now is used. This is the first time we've seen the word create since verse 1. We're on the fifth day of creation. I don't call it 6 days of creation. I call it the 6 days of restoration. Okay? 6 days of restoration. And finally on day 5, he created. And day six, in fact, day six uses the word bara three times. Elohim created man in his own image. In the image of Elohim, he created him, male and female, he created them. Why the word create three times? We'll look at that as we get further into Genesis. But you might stop and think for a second, oh, wait a minute, Grant. You say he created man, but in the word create means to create out of nothing. Didn't God make Adam out of the dust of the earth? And if you're asking that question, then I want to congratulate you because it's a great question. And I'll give you a fuller answer later, but for right now, here's the answer to that question. Man has a dual nature, physical and spiritual. And so when it describes his body, yes, it's formed, not created, but formed out of the dust of the earth. But the man himself was created. He didn't exist before. God breathes neshama into a man, became a living soul. That's how man was created. It's the creation of a man's soul out of God himself, the formation of his body out of the dirt. So you see both words used with man. It's very unique. But we'll look at that more when we get into chapter, later in the chapter 1 and then chapter 2 as well. There's one other passage that I think is an allusion to this original destruction. Job is a fascinating book. It's a very unique book. And it is the oldest book in the Bible. From best we can tell, it was actually penned before Moses wrote the Torah, actually wrote the Torah down. The events of Job do not precede Genesis, but the writing of the book of Job was written before the book of Genesis was written. You follow? And in Job 9, verses 5 to 7, it says, it is God who removes the mountains. When did Job see mountains removed? They know not how. When he overturns them in his anger, and there's that anger again, who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble, who commands the sun not to shine and sets a seal upon the stars. When did the sun go out? When did the stars go out? It's as if Job, under the inspiration of God's Spirit, is referring to something ancient, something that only happened once in time. The question is, what was God angry about? Who rebelled? What was the cause of all of this destruction? Our best guess is this is when Satan rebelled. And you can read about that in Isaiah 14, verses 12 to 20. Instead of taking time now to read through it, you can jot down the reference, read about it later, and I'm sure it's a familiar passage to you. But in this passage, you once again see the earth trembling and quaking. The world, the aretz, becomes a wilderness. Remember that word, midbar, wilderness, we saw back in Jeremiah? Same word is used here. We see all abodes destroyed, just as in Jeremiah. The Ezekiel passage is the one about Satan, Ezekiel 28, 12 to 29. Won't take time to read it this morning, but read this passage. It talks about Satan, and it says of him that he was at one time perfect, wise, and beautiful. He was in Eden, the garden of God. He was the anointed cherub. He was on the holy mountain of God. He walked among the stones of fire. That's a fascinating, fascinating phrase that, again, we'll look at later when we get into Exodus, actually. But he became proud. His wisdom was corrupted due to his pride. Did you know if you're a proud person, you're making yourself stupid? This is why the word says humility is the beginning of wisdom. Pride is the beginning of stupidity. Show me a person who's proud, I'll show you one who's dumb. Oh, his IQ might be through the roof, but he's a fool. But anyways, that's another story. Through his rebellion, he profaned his sanctuaries. Again, things we'll look at in the future. And it says he will be destroyed because of his wicked deeds. So, you start to get the picture a little bit. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And you know what? If the scientists want to say that multi-celled creatures evolved out of single-celled creatures, I don't care. I'm going to quote you just a short paragraph from the book. so you get a little bit of a jump start. And I thought, I could just read what I've written here. It's better than me just yammering on. It says, if there is indeed a pause between the first two verses of Genesis, then it would mean that Adam and Eve were created on a planet that was older than just 6 days. In fact, let the scientists make the planet as old as they wish. It does not affect the narrative of Genesis. If they wish to claim that the Earth is billions of years old, let them. In fact, if they even wish to propound that multi-celled life forms evolved from simple-celled life forms, let them. If they want to surmise about the age of the dinosaurs, when they existed, and rely on carbon dating to prove their hypotheses, let them. It makes absolutely no difference to the Bible narrative, because Genesis 1:2 tells us that the original ancient earth became formless and void. Everything was wiped out. No creature survived. And that, as they say, was that. But it is at the point in time when God begins his work of restoration that we pick up the narrative in verse 3. This is why the word bara is all but absent during those 6 days. With the exception of the creation of the animals and man, it was a time of restoration, not creation. Make sense? Children can understand this. And this stands up to all the attacks of so-called science and evolution and all that. And also perfectly harmonizes and agrees with everything in the scriptures. And you know when you read in 2 Corinthians 5, it says, if any man is Messiah, he's a new creation. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are made new. You know, in Hebrew, there's no difference between the word new and the word renew. This is why the Brit Kadashah, New Covenant, can be called the Renewed Covenant. Because when you read about it in Jeremiah 31, it's really a covenant God made that he's renewing. And so when you read Paul saying, if any man's Messiah, and he was thinking Hebrew, he wrote in Greek, but he's thinking Hebrew, he's a renewed creation. All old things are passed away, but all things are renewed. And we're going to look next week at how these 6 days of restoration exactly parallel the work God does in the human soul as they draw close to him. It starts with light coming into their lives, and it ends with them being a man in God's image, a woman in God's image, given mission and given a work to do in this world. That's what the first chapter is really about. It's about what God's done in us to make us renewed creatures. We all start out kind of formless and void, you know, chaotic and empty, dark in the depths. But God does this amazing work. I have to share this one last thing. There's more, but this is good enough. This is a good place to end. I came across this amazing book years ago, and I thought, this is a book I'm not letting out on my site, because it is so amazing. Rabbi Arya Kaplan wrote the book, and in it he quotes a lot of ancient texts that are not even translated into English. And he tells about Rabbi Isaac ben Samuel of Acre, or better known as Rabbi Isaac of Akko. He was born in Israel in 1250, the best we can guess, 1250. Now stop to think for a moment, 1250. This is 2016. How many years difference is that? A little over about 700, almost 8, right? So we're talking about almost 8 centuries ago this guy was born. He fled to Spain in 1305 due to Muslim persecution. While there, became a student of the great Torah sage Moses ben Nachman Gerundi, who's better known as the Ramban. It's like the Rabbi Bagbag, you know. It's a Ben Bagbag, this is Ramban. One of these days I'll explain how they come up with these names. He lived from 1194 to 1270. And while he was his student, Rabbi Isaac wrote a book called Sefer HaTamuna, in which he made an astounding claim. This is what he claimed. He calculated the age of the universe based upon numerical values of Hebrew words and texts and verses, and he came up with this as the age. 15,340,500,000 years old. And then, just less than 100 years ago, about 75 years ago, scientists realized, you know what, the universe actually had a beginning. Up to then, at that time, accepted science was the universe was static. It was just there. Now they realize the universe is expanding. Well, if it's moving out, where did it move from? And they can look and measure, and they realize everything came from one particular point. And that there was what they call the Big Bang. In fact, the first science called the Big Bang was making fun of the theory. But now it's provable theory. It's proven. And it had a beginning. It actually had a beginning. And modern science, they estimate the age of the universe is 14,800,000,000 years old, roughly. Now look at that. Those are pretty close. If 14,800,000,000 years is correct, then this 14th century rabbi, Rabbi Isaac, he was over 90% accurate with his estimation based strictly on the Bible. I have a feeling the scientists still have to do some adjusting. Because I have found in my experience, science is always catching up to the Bible, not the other way around. And I'm sharing this with you so that you'll understand the theology I'm sharing with you is not a theory and it's not Grant's theology. This is around long before Darwin was born, long before some notion of evolution came into being, long before science ever came up with its ideas. This is much older. Now, this period of destruction is what the scientists call the Ice Age. And they've come up with ideas that a meteorite hit the earth and caused this ash cover, which blocked out the sun and caused the dinosaurs to die and the plants and so on. Could be. Didn't Yeshua himself say that I saw Satan falling from heaven? Does the Revelation refer to this great star falling to the earth, like this event will happen a second time? I don't know, just a thought. But some of the ancient mystical writings of Judaism, writings that go back nearly 2,000 years, say this. I'll quote these quickly, and then we'll close. The first one, quote, when it talks about how the earth was formless and void, this is what it says, quote, "It was at first in its proper state, but now tohu and vohu, having diminished itself and its light." And another translation puts it this way. "Was" indicates that it was originally in its ordered state, but now it has become formless and void and dark. So even there, 2,000 years ago, rabbis are writing about the earth was originally in its perfect state, but it became formless and void. How about this one? Oh, I love this. Let's see, where is it? It is I should read this sometime. Okay. I will find it. Okay, here we go. I do have it. Oh, here we go. Listen to this. Quote, "At first, all the powers of the earth were latent and not productive, and the waters were frozen inside it and did not flow. They only spread abroad when a light from above was shed upon the earth. For when this struck it with its rays, its powers were released." It's talking about how the earth was originally frozen. There's another place that says this. It says the words "the earth was formless and void" have already been explained. "Was" indicates that it was originally in its ordered state, but now it has become formless and void. "Everything was destroyed in 12 hours, as written, was without form and void," was tohu and vohu. "They will be established with mercy. They are renewed as before. because it is written created, and afterward is written was, became. This is because it certainly was, and in the end it is without form and void, because it was destroyed. Pretty fascinating stuff. And one last one. It talks about this serpent in the sea. I have no idea what that means. But listen to what it says. When the serpent enters the temple in the sea, the temple is defiled. Its lights are extinguished. Thus the supernal lights leave the waters. Then the waters of the sea split and go to the left. Then the sea freezes and its waters do not flow. It's very symbolic language, isn't it? But this writing from 2,000 years ago describes an ice age, when the world is destroyed by ice. And so I'm just throwing these things out there, and hopefully it begins to make some sense. And then when you teach your children, your grandchildren, and they ask you, where did the dinosaurs come from? How old is the world? You begin to speak from scriptural truth, the foundation of accuracy, and not some kind of nonsense that science can easily destroy and their faith along with it. That makes sense? I know this was a very spiritual teaching, but I think it's an important one. And I think we need to arm ourselves with the truth. The scriptures don't need improved upon. They don't need changed. And the God who created and destroyed and restored the creation, he's given us enough information here so we can know what he did. So let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time. And Lord, I pray you take the things that were shared and help them make sense to our minds. And maybe we have rethinking to do, but I pray you grant us the courage and the joy just to embrace what your word is stating. And Father, if there is disagreement, I pray you'd grant grace and love that we would still be brothers and sisters, and the enemy would not use us as an occasion to bring in a division. So Lord, may you be glorified, and may your truth reign, and continue to open our hearts and minds to your magnificent ways, your wonderful ways, and the truths that have been here for so long, hidden in your word. We thank you for it, and we praise you in Yeshua's name. Amen.